And the higher up the officials were in the United States who had been dealing with Iran over a long period, the more likely it was that they knew a lot of people who were in serious trouble. On the other hand, there were an awful lot of Americans who had always disliked the Shah. The Shah was an acronym. I mean, someone who claimed to be a total monarch or a total dictator. In an age when dictators and monarchs have long since become museum pieces, it was an anachronism. He was certainly out of his time and never tremendously respected anyway by the American officials. Too many people just knew that he'd been supported or been put back into power, dragged back from Rome by CIA and installed again in his throne, and too many people knew what his sisters and brothers were like. He was not Mahatma Gandhi or even Mother Teresa or even I don't think anybody really cared about him, to tell the truth. You could see part of that with the Carter decision not to let him into the United States. It went on for months and months too. I think the Carter administration, the people in the White House, sort of stood there saying, what do we owe him? He had the country in his hands for 30 or 40 years and screwed it up. We don't owe him anything. There were others, of course, some of the banks, the Rockefellers, Kissinger, people who had financial interests in the Shah, who wanted him into the United States.
I'll also come up again, this question of the return of the Shah.
Now, at the stage of the game, in early, February, March, April, 79, the following months, how much of a grasp did you and the political officers get or develop of the workings of the political system that was emerging during this period?
That's difficult to answer. We knew an awful lot about individuals, about a lot of individuals. The system itself was still so veiled, it still is heavily veiled in Iran. I don't think anyone, including any Iranian that I respect to them, could have given a very good sort of black and white portrayal of how the government was working. Things were still in too much chaos. There were still too many revolutionary groups, too many people with power bases who were often in conflict with one another. Too many groups that were fighting each other, although both were so-called revolutionary groups. But too many of all of these conflicting factors to say that the system is as follows. Don't forget, the country was operating then without a constitution. There was no legal basis for the government, no legal sort of framework for it. So you can't really talk about the system. The system was, in a lot of cases, chaotic. Executions were carried out by people who had no authority. Prisons were being filled right and left. You had people from the government who were being hauled into prison. People who were working for the revolutionary government would be taken out of their offices and put in prison that day. It was all sort of, and certainly an awful lot of chaos in the smaller towns and cities.
Apparently there was a revolutionary council at the top. How much was known about it as membership?
Very little. Yeah. In fact, there were conflicting reports about who was on it, and this will sound a bit strange. I am not convinced that the members of the council necessarily knew that they were in charge of the country. For example, when Taleghani died, Taleghani was the Ayatollah, from one of the leading revolutionary Ayatollahs from Tehran. There were conflicting stories from members of his family on television about whether he was or was not a member of the Revolutionary Council. I think it was his wife who said he never had been, and his son said, of course he was, and I don't remember right now, but I remember there was a real conflict in all the accounts of it. Khomeini, of course, would have been consulted or would have been, you know, the spiritual leader of such a thing, but then again, which other clergy were on it? You would have had people coming and going from various of the major cities, and they would have sat in groups on the floor in Khomeini's house or in some other clergyman's house, and I would suppose that that night they constituted the council, and the next night in some other house, some other group. You know,
it was sort of incoherent, I guess.
I think a lot of it was, yes. And a lot of the people we know of today, of course, were not powerful enough then to have been on it. Remember that a lot of the early leadership was wiped out, either by assassination very quickly, or by being blown up, or by running away and deciding they weren't revolutionary and really wanted to live in California.
To what extent did you see factual divisions among the revolutionaries?
Order of the day.
Well, how would you describe the factual divisions that you saw?
Oh, God. I was talking to everything from people who called themselves communists to people who, were dividing themselves up by which of the religious leaders they followed, by people who said they were Mujahideen, people who said they were Fedayeen, people who said they were pro-American, people who, were this, that, the other thing. It was every possible group you could think of. Liberal Democrats, all sorts. People who wanted the Shah to come back, people who wanted Khomeini to reign forever because they thought he was immortal. It was the spring of chaos.
When you were meeting with the various revolutionary individuals in Tehran, was there any suspicion of you because you had such fluent Parsi and through the country?
Iranians have always suspected people who could speak Parsi.
Yeah.
They're paranoid. And they could never understand why anybody would want to learn Persian. Many Iranians don't speak it well themselves. And they've they assume that anyone who studies it on purpose must have an ulterior motive. But when I say I was meeting with revolutionary groups, it was all happening quite naturally. I didn't go out looking for, local cells or sneaking around like that. It was basically, I continued my normal social life, which was a different place for lunch and a different place for dinner every day of the week. And by doing that, I was always in situations where there were 5 or 10 or 30 or 40 people present. And so my social activity covered the gamut of the revolutionary, anti-revolutionary, whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, people kept changing too, depending on how their own interests were being met or preserved during 1979. There are very few Iranians who are ideologically pure. Mm-hmm. Attachment is very often self-interest rather than ideology.
Among those who were among the revolutionaries, they were all members of a committee?
A lot of people I knew were on various committees,
yeah.
A lot. And some took an active role, I'm thinking especially of the younger men, or various sons or brothers of my friends. The committee system older people did not join it, normally. You might have some older men who were advisors to a committee group or who had so little going in their own lives that they had the time for it. But basically, older people weren't in evidence. And also, after the first week or so, became, number one, dangerous, and number two, uncomfortable. If you had to stand guard all night long at the entrance to some alley, this is no longer, something you want to do in your middle age.
Were women involved in the committees? The female membership?
I don't recall any. Women were involved in a whole group of other things, in a lot of provision of services, especially. I know the Talagani group had a lot of women in it, but they were basically working in the clinic that distributed medical aid to people. Women standing behind barricades in front of alleys, in front of streets, I don't recall.
Now, you mentioned earlier there were sort of lots of illogical currents in the country. There are people called
a variable cesspool.
Yeah. Communists, liberal Democrats, and so forth. Do the communists correspond to those kinds of currents? Or were the members of communists who were called themselves communists and others called themselves liberal Democrats? Or was it more diversity within them?
No. I would say there was more diversity and, you know, basically more diversity than that. Now, what was happening, of course, was that people who were similar in political outlook, the Mujahideen or the Fedayeen or the Communists or whatever, had their own groups of activists who were doing other things. And also infiltrating the comité structure at the same time. You know, they would have representatives not necessarily known to the normal comité people. They would have people who were infiltrating the comité structure as sort of an insurance or for intelligence purposes. But normally, as far as I remember, the comités were all basically sort of, you know, rather religious, whatever, and just, you know, pro-Khomeini and anti-imperialist.
In terms of membership of the comités, as you saw it, was it pretty much cross-class, or was it did some social classes predominate? Or was there a mixture of social classes?
Even the comités themselves, you had somewhat of a mixture for this reason. The comités were basically neighborhood groups or district groups. And so, in the lower part of the city, or the poorer part of the city, you had the sons of the poorer residents of the city. When you got up into the middle class and upper middle class areas, you had their sons on the comités, or their brothers, you know, the men from those groups. In many cases, I ran across people, you know, men or boys who were in various comités that had taken control of this building or that building or whatever, who were really upper class. In fact, some of them were very upper class. I got to know one very, very well, a guy who was in a comité, spoke excellent British English. Father was a cabinet member for the Shah. He didn't advertise the fact. In fact, nobody knew that he came from such a higher class family. I got to know this as I got to know him much better. In fact, it was strange. He was a member of one of the comité groups like that, and his uncle, who was a very high official, was executed at the same time. But you see, you had this too. And you have to remember that. And, you know, the classic case of insurgencies and political groups of this, you know, of this nature, very often it's the sons of the upper class who join. An awful lot of Iranian students came back to Iran from their good private schools in the United States and England and Germany and France to take part in the revolution. And, you know, it did cut across in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Did you have much contact with active opponents of the revolution?
Yeah.
From what standpoint did they oppose the new regime?
A lot of it was self-interest. Property was being confiscated right and left. Mm-hmm. And even though you had been anti-Shah, or claimed you had been all through 1978, and of course, by 1978, you were claiming you had been all your life, even if you'd been living in his bedroom up until then. If you were about to lose your house or your farm or, you know, this or that, or your business had just gone into self-destruct because there was no more business, you were becoming anti-revolutionary or anti-Khomeini. Also, the middle and upper middle classes, their lifestyle was being threatened very much by the revolution. And there were all sorts of stories by 78-79, late 78-79, of, you know, women who were badly mistreated because they didn't wear Islamic garb, or, you know, men who were taken and flogged because they'd been drinking alcohol. Well, these were things that the middle and upper middle classes did. A lot of people also lost their jobs immediately with the revolution because the companies they worked for disappeared. And lost their jobs, lost their income. And it only occurred to them then that when they'd been screaming about foreign companies, you know, should leave Iran, that this meant that their foreign company, their employer, was also going to leave. So a lot, you know, I'm not saying everybody by any means, but there were a significant number of people who were being badly hurt economically, socially, lifestyle, or physically hurt by the continuation of the revolution, and were getting upset about it. And they hadn't thought about this up until Khomeini's return. And also, by the way, just to add this on, don't forget that there were significant revolutionary groups that had grouped together, banded together in 1978 to get rid of the Shah, but they did not want Khomeini to take his place. And among these groups you had the People's Fedayeen, the Mujahideen, very numerous too. We're talking hundreds of thousands. You know, the ones who consider themselves straight Marxists or whatever.
Secular left. Yeah.
The secular left. Yeah. The lots of religious figures who disagreed with Khomeini. An awful lot of clergy were defrocked when Khomeini came back. But, you know, you had a fair number of people like that. Some of whom I knew, many of whom I didn't, but, you know, certainly in my normal going out every night, spending lots of time in the streets and, you know, people's homes and shops and businesses, I met a lot of people like that.
I thought one of the guerrilla organizations had a more religious outlook. I was more, I'm not sure what's the Fedayeen or the other religion being, but
the Mujahideen still do have a fairly religious outlook, but they never liked the idea of clergy, or, you know, high-ranking clergy. The Ayatollahs don't have any role in the Mujahideen concept of Islam. You also had another super-religious group called Forgan in the early days of the revolution that concentrated on killing clergy, because they didn't think that clergy should mix in politics, and, you know, it goes on like that. So you had a whole wide bouquet of pro and anti groups.
Among the antis, I assume you got a lot of requests for American support.
One way or the other. God, everybody was requesting American support. I mean, America was being blamed for supporting every group, and it was being requested, you know, aid was being requested by every group.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And our basic approach was to listen to people, but to stand back.
What was the attitude of the women that you might have met during the course of your time there, that their attitude towards developing policies of the government, towards the role of women in society?
You had a whole range of reaction. I met women who were Iran was always filled with women who were very, very traditional, very religious. I knew a number of those. I knew a number of women who were getting more and more upset because the clothing laws were changing. They couldn't go out on the street in normal clothes anymore. They had to wear a veil, and they never had in their whole lives. Normal middle, upper middle class women. Women's reaction ranged from everything from, you know, full support of the revolution, except that it hadn't gone far enough, and, you know, to outright hatred and disgust with the revolution. It was a whole combination of things. Remember that it was the summer of 1979 when Gloria Steinem came to Tehran, too, to take part in a big demonstration of, you know, women's rights. But Iranian women were both pro, anti. It's hard to divide it by, you know, sex. You can't really. A lot of women also at this period, this reversed itself later, but in 1979, a lot of women were being bounced from their jobs in the government ministries. And basically being told to go home and get married, and get conservative, and sit, you know, in the kitchen.
Did you have contacts with military people?
Sure, a lot.
That was part of your responsibilities too?
Yeah, because I was doing a lot of reporting on political, military, you know, well, a whole social reporting, etc.
Yeah, certainly. What was the ranking of the military people that you met? Was it from at all levels?
The generals were gone. No, I shouldn't say that. I knew a couple of generals who had been old, who had been retired, in a, you know, had long since been retired. Everything from lieutenant on up to colonel, military and police. Some of them had trouble, some of them had not. Some of them were out of their jobs, others were not. And, you know, there was certainly no problem with it. They were all part of the social scene in Tehran. We weren't planning any coups. I was listening to what they were saying. Because it was rather important that we knew, that we know what the military was thinking, the revolutionary military, the new military, what was going to happen to the military structure. We still had a tremendous physical investment in the Iranian armed forces. That was, I might add, by the way, that was only a peripheral interest of mine. We had a, you know, a defense attaché's office that was still functioning, still had people in it, and their job was to maintain liaison contact with the Iranian military. So they would have been professionals doing it.
Apparently during this period, the early months of 79, after the revolution had occurred, or the transfer of power to Bazargan and Khomeini, there were some discussions at the embassy about a possible meeting with Khomeini. Did you take part in any discussions of that question?
I heard certainly quite a bit about it. I'm not, you know, I know that we never did have a meeting with him. I'm no longer sure of the reasons. Certainly, people in the embassy were quite willing. He was obviously the head of the country. The Soviet ambassador had already groveled down to home, been yelled at in public, and kept going back for more. We didn't do it. I'm not sure why now. I would guess because Ambassador Sullivan would not have been appropriate. He was too linked to the Shah. By the time he left, of course, the new ambassador was about to come out. The Iranians refused to accept him.
Because of the Javits resolution, right?
I'm not sure. I think that may have been. I'm not sure of the actual reasoning at the time. Yes. That was a particularly sensitive issue, the Javits statements in Congress, considering that Mrs. Javits worked for the Shah. One had to wonder why it was Senator Javits
taking these resolutions.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And his wife was an agent for the Pahlavi Foundation, as far as I remember.
I've read things to that effect.
We're talking self-interest here. It's amazing how you can get very, very sort of the word I want to use, very political when you're getting paid for it.
Back to this question of Khomeini, though, did your political and religious contacts in Tehran, did they think that would have been a desirable?
Yeah, both ways.
Yeah.
For anytime we ask to run an opinion of something, we get it in a whole, you know, slew of... I'm not sure that Khomeini would have been too interested at that point. The thing about meeting him, we had contact with everybody and anybody around him, including members of his family. And so it just didn't come off. I don't know whether that's fortunate or unfortunate now.
One of the big issues that was raised by the Iran-Contra affair last year was the question of U.S. contacts with the Iranian moderates, quote-unquote. Now, in some way, this issue seems to go back to 79, when there was contact with such people as Entezan, among others, in the government.
Sure.
Now, how valid do you think the term moderate is in the context of the Iranian revolution?
Actually, despite my refusal to use the word moderate in the last couple of years, it's a very valid word. There were and are Iranians in the government, in the power structure, in every possible profession, including clergy, including Revolutionary Guard, including high-ranking military in today's Revolutionary Armed Forces, who are, you know, benignly inclined towards the West and towards the United States. They have always been there. At some point or another, at one point or another, their interests in this relationship with the United States will outweigh the benefits of the relationship, will outweigh the disadvantages of it, and they will express, simply take up contact again. But, you know, are there people who are pleasantly, benignly, positively inclined towards the United States? Yes, an awful lot. Should they be encouraged? Yes, I guess so, if we're interested eventually in a relationship. Should we sell them arms? No. But are there people like that? Yes. Since 1979, a couple of 100,000 Iranians have come and gone from the United States and come to and gone back to Iran from. These include Iranian officials, Iranian diplomats, Iranian this, Iranian clergy, etc., 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 their families, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins. They have family here and relatives here. They have interests here. They have interests in Iran. Many of them work for the Iranian government. A lot of them are not fanatic, not hateful, not evil or whatever. They're normal people. If by moderate you mean them, yeah, there are lots of moderates. You have to, one other thing about that, moderate is of course such a political term now because of the Only North, you know, brouhaha, but it's always worth remembering that the United States and Iran have a lot of contacts still, contacts of business, of education, of family relationships, communications ties. And you can't simply, these have not been cut off by the revolution. In fact, a surprising amount of communication and contact has been encouraged by the revolutionary government. Iranian students continue to come to the United States. The best Iranian students from the university, the top, you know, members of the graduating class, are still given fellowships to come to America to continue on for master's and doctoral programs. Iranians have never been forbidden to travel here. They've come here and, you know, I think I used the figure a couple of 100,000. It is something like that since the revolution. A couple of 100,000 visas given. The phone is still direct dial between any American city and any Iranian city. In fact, that system was only installed, or, you know, sort of opened up after the revolution. Right? It goes on like that. And there, I heard an estimate once of something like 5,000 calls a day between Iran and the United States, telephone calls. So what can I say? And I continue to meet Iranians at dinners and at parties and at receptions who have just arrived from Iran yesterday, and whose husbands are high officials, or they themselves are deeply tied to the Iranian government. And they're very pleasant, decent people. we don't like a lot of what they've done, but an awful lot of them haven't been responsible for what's happened. There are not 50 million people out seizing hostages.
Now, one of the issues raised by one issue that during 79, CIA, some CIA people in Tehran, or in Iran and outside of Iran, were probably in contact with some of the moderate figures such as Antazam.
In 79?
According to James Bill's account. They were trying to develop political relations with these people and cultivate them. So I've read. Was this something that was... You don't know about this at the embassy in 79. Was this known for CIA efforts?
I know Antazam's family socially, but I knew them a long time before the revolution, so it never occurred to me that anybody would be silly enough to try and establish a relationship.
Apparently George Cape and others were engaged in those activities in 79 and 80.
And Antazam, you have to remember, is somebody who was educated in the United States, lived here for many years, and has a fair amount of business investment in the United States. Mm-hmm. He owns a couple of restaurants in California. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the, one of many who were in that situation. Mm-hmm. That whole cabinet was... They were not anti-American. They would have been damaging their own interests if they had been. Mm-hmm. Yazdi's wife and children never came back to Iran. They simply stayed in Houston because they are all American citizens and didn't want to come back to Iran. Mm-hmm. It goes on like that. Mm-hmm. So establishing ties. These were the same sort of people we had worked with before, except these didn't wear silk ties. Mm-hmm. They had open shirts.
Now, in his book, James Bill also suggests that one of the reasons that the U.S. emphasized contacts with the moderates was by default to some extent, because there was so little contact with the religious leaders. Does that sound plausible in any way?
It sounds like something that can't be proved or disproved.
Yeah, yeah.
We had contacts. Normal, sort of embassy contacts with a whole wide range of people. Did we purposely seek out moderates? It's a word that wasn't used then, as far as I remember. It's a new word. Did we purposely seek out a particular group of people and place all of our eggs in their basket? No. On the other hand, access to higher figures in the religious hierarchy would have been very difficult at the best of times.
That's what he's trying to say, that it was more or less by default to say access was so difficult to the religious people. Other ties were developed and emphasized.
Well, I don't know. I never really thought about the political orientation of my friends or the people I was dealing with. I never really thought about whether they were moderates or liberal or conservative or whatever. Mm-hmm. They were just people I knew. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned that the ties, it was very difficult to develop relationships with religious leaders, ayatollahs, among others. Were there any contacts?
Let's put it this way. It would have been difficult for even normal Iranians. By the time you are an ayatollah or a ranking religious leader, you're existing in a very circumscribed world. It would be equally difficult for someone to develop a relationship here with a cardinal, for example. Mm-hmm. By the time someone is that high ranking in religious terms, their access to them is strictly controlled. In Iran, during the time of the Shah, it would have been difficult for security reasons to meet people like that, as well as their own. I don't know of any Iranian ayatollahs who were particularly hospitable to any foreigner. Mm-hmm. This is not their bag.
Exactly.
They didn't particularly want to meet Christians or Jews anyway, you know, why?
But what about the people around them? Were there contacts with their students,
they
I guess, or their followers?
No,
or?
They weren't considered a political group as such. Mm-hmm. And, you know, think of it this way. How much luck? The United States is an open society. Would you say that? You could basically meet anybody here that you want to meet.
You know, if you really... Certain social constraints.
Certain social constraints. But basically, if you want to focus on it. But how much luck do you think a foreign diplomat would have in getting into a seminary that's training diocesan priests there? It would be kind of rough. And even if you were invited once to it, it's not as though you could hang around mm-hmm. or start inviting the novices out to your house for dinner. It just wouldn't be, you know, it's not... It's a different type of society. Now, if somebody happened to be a scholar and were known for Islamic credentials or were known to be writing the history of Islam or whatever, then it's a lot easier. Then you have a reason. But to try and establish a set of contacts with a religious house, I mean a religious, seminary or something, it just isn't done anywhere, really. It's not even done if you're the same religion, particularly.
I see the difficulty.
Imagine an American official trying to establish a relationship with the members of a religious commune here. And as an example, and good luck.
Of course, I think that's more significant in Iran because since the religious groups had so much political influence,
yeah.
I mean, it'd be more logical to at least try to think about building contacts because of the political power associated with these, as opposed to the seminar in this country.
Ooh!
Well, there's obviously political influence, but
yes.
Not necessarily the commanding heights of the society. No.
Have you met any cardinals recently?
No. It gets complicated, obviously.
But also, these, you know, their political influence was very much a factor in 1978. Mm-hmm. Wasn't necessarily true in 1975 or 76, mm-hmm. even 77. Mm-hmm. And it was only, not by chance, but it was a bit exceptional that all of the anti-Shah sentiment focused on Khomeini. It could easily, just as easily, have focused on some National Front leader or some communist or some mujahid or whatever. By the time it was clear that all of the opposition was going to come under the sort of the umbrella of Khomeini's figure, or Khomeini's name, it was really too late.
Turn this off for a second. This book, James Bill, suggests that one of the problems that the U.S. had in Iran in 79 and later was that the Carter administration more or less refused to publicly announce as a sign of goodwill, its acceptance of the revolution. To what extent did you and your colleagues see that as a problem?
It wasn't a problem. This is all, I think, sort of, you know, people trying to explain 10 years later why something went sour. Mm-hmm. When the revolution occurred, when Khomeini came back into power, or when he came into power, when he anointed or appointed cabinet and under Bazar Khan, we immediately had normal relations with the government appointed by Khomeini. Mm-hmm. We had every day, daily, you know, weekly, whatever, we had meetings constantly with them. We kept the embassy open and functioning. And by the summertime, at the government's request, their government, we had reopened our consular section. It was a full-service consulate, giving visas to Iranians. We had any number of visitors come from Washington at various levels to meet with new government figures. We had an ambassador in Iran until Ambassador Sullivan left. A new ambassador was named in the United States, Walt Cutler. He was supposed to come to Iran. The Iranians refused to accept his naming. But, you know, certainly we continued as much as possible normal relations. And for anyone to say that we didn't recognize the revolution or didn't recognize the new government is ignoring facts. I mean, we stayed there. We processed things normally. We're building up our presence significantly again.
Well, it's not, it's not a question of recognition or non-recognition. I guess it's a question of whether the U.S. was going to state that it accepted the revolution.
That becomes absurd.
Do we expect
a foreign government to say that they accept the election of the president in November? No. You simply continue relations or you break relations. We never broke relations. We continued, and after the initial evacuation, of most American dependents and families, etc., people started coming back. Mm-hmm. Businesses were reopening. It was the security situation in Tehran and the other cities that prevented Americans from coming back in larger numbers. Mm-hmm. But certainly we had, an embassy staff that was building up and very decent relationships with a large number of Iranian Khomeini-appointed government officials. Mm-hmm. Including meetings with many of the top clergymen in Iran. And it just, what can I say? He is ignoring facts when he says that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some of the moderates of the government, people, Qazirgan, and Dizamov and others, complained at various points that the U.S. is undermining their position by refusing to supply spare parts that were needed, that were already paid for, or to repatriate government funds that were held in the United States. Do those issues come up in conversations?
No, not that per se. I know that the spring and summer of 1979, we were spending a lot of time trying to sort out some incredibly complicated property matters with the Iranian government, including the seizure, confiscation of large amounts of American military property there. We had things like the APO, the commissary, the PX, large shipments of military freight, etc., etc. That was being sorted out. And also, meetings were continuing with the defense attachés and the Army Schmag people, the military advisory group representatives, about things like items in the pipeline, etc. That would have been worked out. It was in the process of being worked out. Mm-hmm.